Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by The Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy welcomes University of Maryland history professor Kathleen Waters Sander. Her new book, John W. Garrett and the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad, is a vivid and gripping account of Garrett's 26-year reign at the helm of the legendary railroad and of how its success ignited railroad fever throughout America. Thursday, October 26th at 7 p.m. at The Ivy. More at theivybookshop.com or call 410-377-2966.
Hello again from the Baltimore Sun. I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Roughly Speaking, episode 313 for Tuesday, the 24th of October, 2017. It did not take long for the controversy about how and how often the current president of the United States communicates with Gold Star families to spill into the steaming cauldron of race and racism. This time, both the president and his chief of staff criticized a black woman, this time a member of Congress from Florida, for her public condemnation of the president's tone and words in a phone call to another black woman, the widow of an army sergeant killed in action in Africa. The president called the congresswoman wacky, and her account of the phone call totally fabricated, while the chief of staff, John Kelly, criticized her for allegedly bragging about having secured the funding for an FBI field office in Miami dedicated to two FBI agents killed in the line of duty. If that seems strange, Kelly's description of what happened at that dedication ceremony turned out to be false. That he even brought up the matter, which had nothing to do with the issue of the phone call to Sergeant LaDavid Johnson's widow, led the congresswoman to charge that the White House is full of white supremacists. Race and racism is right here, right in front of us, and it seems almost every step of the way when it comes to the current administration in Washington, whether we're talking about immigration policy, criminal justice, neo-Nazis, Confederate statues, or the National Football League and Colin Kaepernick. Today on the show, a talk about race and racism with a black woman who has written a powerful and passionate memoir about growing up biracial in a racially polarized country. Julie Lithcott-Hames has poured her heart into descriptions of what she calls the microaggressions and blunt insults she experienced as the daughter of a white mother and African-American father. Here's how the book opens. It opens with the words, "Where are you from?" Where are you from? Here? No, I mean, where are you from? As a child growing up in the 70s and early 80s in New York, Wisconsin, and Northern Virginia, there was something about my skin color and hair texture that snagged the attention of white children and adults. Their need to make sense of me, to make something of sense out of nonsensical me, was pressing. My existence was a ripple in an otherwise smooth sheet. They needed to iron it down. The truth is, I'm not really from here. The truth is, that's not what they were asking. Julie Lithcott-Hames is a former dean at Stanford and the author of a 2015 book about the harms of helicopter parenting. That book was titled, How to Raise an Adult. Now, a very different book, a memoir of poetic prose called Real American. I've so enjoyed this. I've learned a lot from it. It's answered questions I've had in my head for years about black people, about people from mixed marriages, the children of mixed marriages. And it was really helpful. I do want to ask you about the way the book looks.
Yeah.
And the short, very short chapters sometimes. It's almost like reading poetry. I mean, you have a great style.
Thank you.
I'll say that. But there are some pages where I looked at it and I thought, is this missing? Is this a review copy they sent me? maybe there's something wrong here. Because on some pages, there's just like two or three paragraphs or one paragraph.
Or a sentence. Yes.
And the font is not a font I'm used to seeing in books like this.
Right. So everything that you've described is very intentional. I use a lot of white space because that's my effort to punctuate whatever I've just said. I want the reader to have to pause and think or take it in. In terms of the font.
And let me tell you, That happens.
I'm glad.
It happens.
I'm glad, Dan. Yeah. You know, the font, I drafted it, of course, on my laptop, and I chose a font, and I chose a sans serif font deliberately because this language is stark. This is not a flourished depiction. When they were in the process of pulling together the interior design for the book, they used a serif font, something with flounce. And I said, no, 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 you've missed it. This is not supportive of what I'm trying to convey. And they said, well, it's hard for the eye. You know, we have to really worry about the reader. And I said, you know what? I get that, but find a sans serif font that you think works, because these words were not meant to have the flourish of a serif. You know, the large right margin on every single page was intentional, which they also didn't realize when they bought it. And so the pagination was all off. And I said, no, 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 it's got to have that large right. They said, the book's going to be so long. I said, you know, could we try at least? Could we just see what it looks like? Because the Word document I sold you is how I intend for this book to look. I also had to deal with line spacing and, you know, they were breaking words with a hyphen. And I said, nope, you know, fill, you know, every word deserves its space, not unbroken. And so I did a lot of arguing of really trying to be an advocate for these words as the author of them. I know what I intended, and I was really quite insistent upon the final book looking the way that I had intended.
It's really daring. And so
thank you.
Congratulations on getting that done.
Thank you. I appreciate
that. The way you wanted it.
Thank you.
It comes up several times, at least I think it comes up several times in the book, where you're questioned about why you identify as black. And I like the way you deal with that, but let's talk about that a little bit, because this came up with Obama. You know, I hear white people say, well, wait a minute, how is he the black president?
Right.
Why isn't he the white president or the mixed race president?
Right. So the quick answer to that is because America doesn't see him as white and America doesn't see me as white. America's one drop rule, which goes all the way back to earliest slavery days as a way to ensure that the children resulting from the rape of black women at the hands of white masters, that those children would also be slaves. We had to have this rule that said one drop of black blood, they called it. One drop is a stain that stains whiteness. So if you have any blackness in you, you're black. Fast forward to, you know, the 1970s when I was a young kid, my parents were an interracial couple. Loving versus Virginia had just been handed down saying their marriage was not illegal. And kids like me were, you know, starting to be born with in greater numbers and so on. My parents were told in the early 1970s, you call your kid black, even though, yes, you have a white parent and a black parent, you call the child black, you try to help them develop a strong, proud black identity because they will be seen as black and the world will treat them as black. So it doesn't serve do them any good to say, well, I'm half white. You know, when you're walking down the street, when you're a black man, a biracial black man walking down the street of Baltimore trying to get a cab, that cabbie doesn't know you have a white parent. That cabbie sees the color of your skin. So this is an effort to help us accept, embrace, and love the black ancestry and brown skin that we've got, despite maybe having a white parent.
When you went to college, you write about how you were eager to be among more black kids and make black friends.
Yeah, because I'd grown up in an all-white community. My parents moved around a lot, but almost always, because of my father's professional success, my parents were choosing the communities with the better public schools or the bigger house or the bigger plot of land, which tended to be white communities. And so my high school in Middleton, Wisconsin was 1,200 white kids and me, a couple Jewish families, you know? And so when I went off to Stanford University with, at the time, 6% black students, I thought, okay, this is finally my chance. I mean, I'd been looking to the Cosby Show, Dan, for evidence about how to be myself. You know, Cliff Huxtable was a physician, as my father was. Denise, his middle daughter, looked kind of like me. And I tuned in every Thursday night for clues because all I had really were media clues about blackness and my parents insisting you're black, yet raising me in white places. I really had to look to media to try to discern what that meant and to try to be the right kind of black person. Because, of course, the media was also shelling me with stereotypes, negative stereotypes about black people. So I was trying not to be the bad stereotype, you know, while constructing some kind of black self that felt healthy and whole.
What do you think about the white person's impression that being fair-skinned or light-skinned is easier?
It is easier. It is easier. I have light skin privilege. I have upper middle class privilege. I've been to schools with big brand names for college and law school. I'm full of privilege. And in many places, many times across these 49 years, I've been treated as black people are treated in this country. And I think in some ways that's what I'm trying to raise awareness about with this book, because many, many folks would assume, oh, she's made it. Yes, I have achieved a whole lot more than many people ever will have a chance to in this country. And yet that hasn't stopped people from calling me the N-word. That doesn't stop people from playing with my hair and acting as if I'm some exotic zoo animal. You know, these microaggressions that we call them. The questions, oh, you go to Stanford, what team are you on? The presumption that I must be at a highly elite academic institution because of my athleticism, not my brains. I mean, those kinds of assumptions and stereotypes dog me or certainly are thrown my way to this day.
I want you to read about this experience with your husband, Dan, going to a cousin's wedding in the Florida Keys in 1996. I thought this was revealing, and I had a question about it. So why don't you just read it, and then I'll ask you my question.
Sounds good. In the spring of 1996, Dan and I attend his cousin's wedding in the Florida Keys. The rehearsal dinner is at a restaurant with lovely views of the ocean, and Dan and I walk down the boardwalk toward it hand in hand. We pass people at outdoor restaurants drinking and laughing in their tropical shirts and white pants. A white man seated at a corner table catches sight of us and begins to stare. I squeeze Dan's hand tight, which is now my cue to him that something is going on. Dan looks in the direction of my gaze and sees it too. We keep walking ahead with purposeful confidence, though feigned. I look back once and see the man continuing to stare at us as we walk. Dan had learned about the white racist sneer. Life with me was beginning to teach him.
The white racist sneer. And you had seen it before.
I'd seen it before. Mm. And of course, I don't know why he was sneering. Maybe he was, you know, having an internal monologue with himself about something in his life. But over time, you see this look and you begin to know what it is and feel the sort of heat of it. I noticed it, Dan, when I was a tiny girl, as a three-year-old, as a four-year-old, living in Rockland County outside of Manhattan. When I went places with my daddy, who was a tall, dark black man, I noticed that some strangers, by no means all, sneered at my father. They saw him coming. They stared. It's almost like their upper lip begins to tremble a little bit, like a dog snarling. And you know, as a little child, it frightened me. You know, I could learn to read people's faces. That's what humans
sure.
do.
Mm.
And my father just kept walking straight ahead. I cite this, you know, I described this earlier in the book. You know, I was pleading with him with my little eyes, you know, Daddy, what's going on? I mean, not with voice, but just, you know, I was trembling too. And my dad just gripped my hand tighter and we just kept walking. So I got that lesson early on. And so I began to be able to discern it, you know, as it arose throughout my childhood.
Are these vivid memories from childhood, or did you find in doing this, in writing this memoir, that a lot of this came back to you that you had maybe blocked or had forgotten?
They're vivid. They were blocked, but not forgotten. You know, they were there. They were there in the crevices, in the caverns of my psyche. Someone asked me recently, you know, wasn't it hard to write all this down? And I paraphrase Maya Angelou and say, it's harder to keep a story like this inside.
What do you say to the white person who says to me, probably not to you, oh, she's overly sensitive.
Yeah.
She's projecting. That's BS. I'm sick of hearing that stuff.
Yeah.
This is what a white person might say to me.
Sure.
That he wouldn't say to you.
Sure,
or
of
she
course.
Wouldn't say to you.
Of course. A lot of thoughts go through my head as you relay that very typical comment. The first is, why are you so angry and so lacking in compassion? Why are you so quick to judge or dismiss a life experience you have not lived? I mean, this brings us right up to the president, Colin Kaepernick, and taking a knee. Sometimes I hear this is a victim narrative, and my response is, if mine is a victim narrative, then white nationalism, white supremacy, the predominant narrative of America is the bully, you know? So don't tell me to shut up. Don't tell me it didn't happen. How about you start to examine why the heck so many of us have these awful experiences in America?
I've had the same reaction to Colin Kaepernick and take a knee and the white reaction to it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, on some level, I will believe people who say this is disrespecting of America and the flag and our military, all of which has become conflated with the national anthem, right? Okay, right. Okay.
And football.
And football, sure, and major league sports, right?
Right.
Okay, why are you so angry that they're doing this? Aren't you listening to what they're saying? You don't want to, actually, white people, you don't want to hear this. You don't want to hear a complaint, the black grievance with police in America.
Right. And yet, like it or not, as folks here in Baltimore know better than most, black and brown people are often found at the hands of law enforcement who will do wrong by them. The cell phone has, you know, been a window into a reality that is not new. And we have a problem in this country. We have a problem in this country. It's a country where too many people seem to think that if you have black or brown skin, that you are inherently problematic, that you are bad, that you are a thug, that you're a criminal, that you're guilty of something. You know, this is the skin God gave us. In the book, I say at some point, you know, your fear of our brown skin is not justified. Jury after jury, grand jury after grand jury keeps saying the police officer's fear was justified. You know, they killed Tamir Rice in Cleveland, the 12-year-old black boy who was holding a toy gun. And even when he was gasping on the floor, on the ground for his life, they knew that he was a child. They knew that the black plastic next to him was a toy gun. They didn't offer him CPR. And he died, this child in broad daylight, taken down by police, and the police were not held responsible. Their fear of him was called justified. Well, here's what's happening. They're fearing brown skin. Brown skin has become almost like a weapon. And so our law enforcement officers who are inclined to feel this way then are they're believed when they say,
forgiven.
I was afraid, forgiven and believe. I was afraid for my life.
Yeah.
You know, there's a story that just breaks, I mean, all these stories break my heart, but one that I write about in the book, Jonathan Farrell. This was in Charlotte, North Carolina. Jonathan Farrell was a black man, 24 years old, had sustained a very bad car crash, got himself, I don't think other cars were involved. So, you know, he had an accident. He wedged, you know, hauls his large body, he's a football player, hauls his body out of the car and goes down the road to get help. At the first house he comes to, he rings the bell. The woman answers. You know, he said, I just was in an accident. I'm hurt. I need help. She decides he's a menacing, scary black man. She calls 911. When the cops show up, he thinks they're there to help him. And they shoot him 10 times. And he's dead. Survived a car crash, but killed for being black in America. He was a Florida A&M football player, you know? I mean, gosh, I've even...
I remember that story, yeah.
Yeah, so these are real things.
And then there's Walter Scott,
yes,
who was running away from,
yes,
a police officer. And then Trayvon Martin. Another excerpt from your book I'd like you to read is on page 210. It references Trayvon.
Yes, it does.
I thought this was also very insightful, too, from Real American.
Yeah, and it may be instructive for your listeners to know I'm a mom. I have a son and a daughter. We watch. We get up the next morning. We give birth to baby boys whom Hollywood finds adorable and who show up in commercials and television shows and are coveted by white audiences for their cuteness. And 10 or 15 years later, we've raised those boys to be men who transition before white eyes into thugs. Some of us live in middle and upper middle class white communities, thinking them safer, thinking them to be the place of arrival, of transcendence. We see Trayvon gunned down in a gated white community, because he looked suspicious, because his skin color and hoodie made him look suspicious, and we gulp down our fear, we who think we have passed into a better status with our money and privilege and degrees, we gasp, knowing we are wrong, know there is no place for us, no place that is ours in America. We have the talk with our sons, teach our sons how to kowtow to police, how not to draw attention to themselves, how to raise their hands in the air, how not to defend themselves even when they are sure they have done nothing wrong, how not to reach into their pockets for anything, not even to turn off their music. Please, baby, remember, do not reach into your pocket, turn off your music. We teach them this while trying to also teach them to love themselves and not to be ashamed of their beautiful black bodies, of their selves.
Yeah, I like the way there's a lack of commas there. It just flows right out of you.
Yeah.
It's beautiful, really.
Thank you. You know, we call it a prose poetry memoir. There are definitely places where the syntax, the rules of syntax are ignored, and I try to let the text expand or contract according to the point I'm trying to make to sort of support the point.
The title, Real American, I had to think about this, and you use it the way you use it in the book. It really made me think about that phrase. He's a real American. And usually that's in reference to a white person and a certain kind of white person, too.
Right.
Usually a male.
Yeah.
Right? Usually a brawny, strutting, fully confident male, you know.
John Wayne.
Yeah.
Andy Griffith.
Yeah. Real
right?
American.
Yeah. Real Americans.
Yeah.
And, you know, I remember Sarah Palin used to use this phrase a lot, and I knew she was never talking about me. And I titled the book Real American for a lot of reasons. One is to say, you know, wait a minute. You know, I'm as real an American as anybody else is. I think it's a fictional concept, the real American, but as long as people are going to use it, we all belong to it. In addition, you know, Dan, my brother Stephen traced our genealogy back, well before the internet, back to a slave named Sylvie who was owned by a man in Charleston, South Carolina in the late 1700s. Sylvie made me a real American. She wasn't regarded as even a human,
right?
But she made me a real American. I'm her great-great-great-great-granddaughter. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I sort of evoke Sojourner Truth. I say, ain't I a real American? As she said, ain't I a woman? And another line I use is, I'm so American, it hurts. You know, I come from people who survived what America did to them. And I'm proud to be here and to live here, but I'm also going to paraphrase now Baldwin, who said, I love this country so much, I want it to be a better place for all of us. You know, they say that if we're critiquing American, we're not real Americans and we should go back to where we came from. And of course, for those of us who are African American, they stole us from our homeland, so we don't know where we came from. We are here. I'm not going back to anywhere. I'm here to try to help America be that more perfect union it had always wanted to be.
See, mostly white people are not hearing that in this NFL take a knee protest.
Right.
Kaepernick started.
Yeah.
They don't hear that protest is a form of patriotism.
You know? Absolutely. And that as Americans, what we enjoy first and foremost over almost any other population of people on earth is our First Amendment that gives us the right to speak freely. And taking a knee is a respectful, dignified way to stage a protest.
I wonder if people respect democracy or understand all
or understand
that.
What it is
or,
even
or do they want since right. they voted for Donald Trump you yeah. know 63 million of them whatever you know
yeah.
do they want an authoritarian type of government now?
Well, they seem to and the news every day is filled with more and more encroachments on our liberties, and Trump is now taking on the mainstream media to such an extent he's threatening to revoke their licenses. I mean, folks, wake up and look around. You know, I mean, this is totalitarianism. This is authoritarianism. This is the beginning of, sure looks like the beginning of the kind of thing we've seen over the decades of the 20th century in other places. It is terrifying.
What were you thinking and feeling when you saw Donald Trump coming? And especially when we get to the November election and he wins.
When I saw it coming, by which I mean when I heard it coming, because I think what I saw was the imagery he was trying to evoke with his rhetoric. And I'm a writer, so I pay attention to language and words. I pay attention to how audiences are moved by language. And what we saw coming really well before Trump, really in response to the nation's first black president, was a whole lot of folks who thought, oh, no, 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 we cannot have a black man in the White House. And they began, some of them, disrespecting President Obama in ways that really disrespected the office itself, that congressman from South Carolina who called him a liar in the middle of one of his speeches to a joint session of Congress. You know, no president had been called a liar by a congressman in that kind of venue ever. So they were almost calling him boy. You know, so you heard that rhetoric coming, and then you see the rhetorical efforts on the right around galvanizing their people and galvanizing candidates. And I began listening to Trump and began hearing what we call that dog whistle for white nationalists and white supremacists, that language that indicates, oh no, we're going to take our country back. I mean, his slogan, Make America Great Again, we all know means make America normal, regular, white again. Mm-hmm. We know that. We knew that. We heard it. What gets me is the supporters who didn't hear that, who say, no, this is about economic disenfranchisement.
Anxiety.
This is about, right?
Economic anxiety.
Like, no, yeah. Fine. Yeah. At best, mm-hmm. what they can say is, you know, I may not be a racist, but I don't mind voting for one, or worse than racist. I may not be a white supremacist, but I don't mind voting for somebody who supports those point of views. So I was dismayed, as the majority of Americans were, to discover that our nation had somehow managed to elect somebody who was going to take us back, not to a time when America was great, but to a time when America was segregated, was a white nation that built itself on the subjugation of black and brown people.
It wasn't just a campaign slogan. It's continued. He's a divisive president.
Absolutely.
He does everything he can do to divide us.
Yeah, I think the response to Charlottesville, the notion of there being, you know, people on both sides or whatever the quote was just, I want to say astonishing, and yet I think if you were astonished, you weren't paying attention, because mm-hmm. this is the evidence that he would say something like that has been there all along.
Also, the call out to the NFL players, you know, that basically you're a son of a bitch if you take a knee. And in some respects, I'm glad he did it, because it kind of re-energized or reanimated the protest.
Yeah, it sure did. You know, just back to the NFL, I mean, I've always wondered, why are our professional sports and college sports games so infused with patriotism and flags and military? Mm. You know, what is that? What is that about? I don't ever want us to be a place where someone is compelled to put their hand over their heart and recite the Pledge of Allegiance or stand up when the national anthem is played. I respect and value the fact that we are a nation where people can think for themselves and the government is not going to coerce them to behave a certain way. That is what it means to be a democracy. So it'll be interesting to see where this goes. You know, I've also been playing with this idea in my mind that black entertainers and black athletes, in the minds of many white folks, are simply there to please them. In other words,
entertain,
right? You want to watch your NFL. You want them to be brawny, strong, hard-hitting, resilient, you know, but you don't want them to have minds. You don't want them to have opinions. Beyonce, when she performed at the Super Bowl halftime in 2016, she wore an outfit that evoked black power when she did her formation mm-hmm. performance. And people were all up in arms about her doing that. And it's the same thing. They want her to sing. They want her to have a beautiful body they'll look at. They do not want her to have a mind and to express it. And I think we've arrived at a place where black folks from all walks of life are saying, I'm a person too, right? Black Lives Matter means I matter too. It doesn't, we're not black supremacists trying to say we only matter, only we matter. We're trying to say we matter too. We have lives, we have experiences, we have minds. And however highly they're paid for the NFL, they still have the right to speak their mind. I mean, in some ways, this NFL requirement that some seem to be suggesting, some of the teams are requiring, you will stand. You know, yeah, they're highly paid, but they're being forced to basically abandon their own ideals and beliefs based on a life experience about what it's like to be a black man in America in exchange for the chance to play for this team. In some ways, it's a very, very modern allegory for enslavement.
I can testify that the email I received after a couple of columns on the subject of mm-hmm. the NFL, mm-hmm. Take a Knee, almost all the mail was from white people, mm-hmm. and almost all of them said they're spoiled millionaires. Mm-hmm. They don't even know what they're protesting. Mm-hmm. Like they have no ability to think.
Nice.
Do you feel you have white allies?
I do.
You say in the book, we wish we didn't need, but we need white allies.
Sure.
Did I get that
correct? Yeah, I think it's we need white allies. I hate that we need white allies. Mm. We need white allies. That's an example of a page with only three sentences on it.
Yeah. That's right, yeah. Do you feel like you have them?
Well, I was going to say the American narrative going all the way back is about the white experience and how whites view America and what whites think of the rest of us. And therefore, as it being still the case, we need white folks to take an interest in the experience of folks who are not like them. We need them to take an interest. We need them to listen. We need them to believe us instead of, oh, are you sure? Oh, is it really a big deal? Oh. How about you just believe us? You know, what would it take for you to actually try to walk in our shoes and believe us? And then be an ally, which means really compassion in action, you know, radical compassion. Flank us. When we're out there saying this happened, this hurt, this was wrong, flank us. And use your white voice and the privilege that comes with it to say, I believe them. It's important. It really is. And of course, my biggest white ally is my white husband, whom I adore, and my white mother. You know, now I'll make the joke. Some of my best friends are white, Dan.
Julie, there's one more excerpt I'd like you to read for our listeners. Page 240.
Yes.
This refers to a Baltimore police officer and something you read.
Sure thing.
So here's Julie again.
Here I am in Baltimore reading this piece. In the summer of 2016, I read a white Baltimore police officer's confessional, but it's not what I am expecting. He's married to a black woman, and she is pregnant with their first child. During the months of her pregnancy, Freddie Gray is transported in the back of a Baltimore police van, handcuffed but not tethered with a seatbelt, and is unable to stop his body from flying around as the van bounces through the streets of Baltimore. Gray's spinal cord snapped during this ride. Gray died. No one was held responsible. This black woman wife of a white male Baltimore officer is pregnant, and neither she nor I nor God can predict the color of her unborn child's skin or its gender. And when a son is born to them, a son of the color of brown, which equals blackness, this white male police officer is quoted in the New York Times as realizing he is now raising a black son in Baltimore. Then he confesses that until he had a black son, he saw the young black kids hanging around on the street corners on his beat as juvenile delinquents in the making. And now he sees them just as kids, enjoying the last few days of summer, what one might call normal. And in the poignancy of this white man's realization that blacks deserve to be seen just as normal humans, I am reduced to angry, helpless tears. Is this what it's going to take? All the racist white folks need to get some blacks in their family? Is this why gay marriage took hold so quickly? Prejudiced straights had a family member or close friend who was gay? If whites produce brown progeny, can we once and for all breed the racism, the white supremacy out of them? Dear God, can we?
And then on the next page, there's just two sentences.
I sleep with a white man. But he's different from the officer I read about in the New York Times. My white man never once thought black kids were thugs. And as more and more African American men start to express the truth of what they experience just trying to go about making their way through life in America, if we could be better at listening to their experience instead of saying, get over it, it's not as bad as you're saying, if we could actually listen, we would become a nation that is so much more compassionate, and boy, is that sorely needed.
Thank you, Julie.
Thank you, Dan. What a great thing to be on Roughly Speaking. I love it.
Julie Lithcott-Hames, a former Stanford dean, lives and writes in California. Her most recent book, published by Henry Holt, is Real American, a fascinating and powerful memoir of poetic prose about race, about growing up a black biracial woman in America. Recommended reading from Roughly Speaking. And that's our show for now. For the producers, Steve Early, Quinn Kelly, and Christina Tasek, I'm Dan Rodericks in the Baltimore Sun Newsroom. Thanks for listening to Roughly Speaking, and we'll see you again soon.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at 6080 Falls Road, located at the intersection of Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. More information can be found at theivybookshop.com or by calling 410-377-2966.